This episode of AV Excel was recorded on June 22nd, 2017. We got TCL's new P-Series Roku TV, finally. A budget 4K TV you won't be frustrated with. Focals, Spark, they got a new earbud. Ripping Blu-rays, is there an alternative to Red Fox? A little bit of help with green surge protectors. What happened to Pioneer's home theater gear? And hey, quite a bit more. Stay tuned.
Testing, 1, 2, 3. All right. I'm not blowing anything out.
Ignorant weasels chewing on your soul. Ignorant weasels. Do you have speed?
Yeah.
Welcome to AV Excel, your guide to the best in home theater gear and content. No matter what your budget is, home entertainment, beautiful music, headphones, in-ear monitors. We might even occasionally, once in a great long while, talk about VR, especially since my PC now has a VR-ready GPU inside of it.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I have the GPU. Apparently, I do not have the CPU.
So. Finally, after 8 years, Robert might be upgrading.
That might be.
His that or for processor.
UHD Blu-ray playback. One of these things will get me to rebuild the workstation.
One of these things is not like the other.
Ha!
Which makes me wonder, like, I will not be able to do UHD Blu-ray playback on an AMD Ryzen home theater PC.
Not today.
Yeah. Maybe eventually.
Yeah. There's always BitTorrent.
Or just ripping them and putting them on a server.
If they're going to make it this challenging. Or software tools.
Software tools. Oh.
For bypassing or increasing the shenanigans.
You know, as tempting as it is to just sit here and talk about potential violations of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act.
Oh, left and right.
We should talk about... Review just went up on The Verge. We haven't had eyes on it yet, but we've heard very, very good things. TCL's P-Series Roku TV review. The Verge says it's the best budget 4K TV you can get.
I like the review, actually. It gets into a lot about how Roku, ever since they've been under threat, it seems, from the various other set-top box manufacturers in terms of what makes them special, one of the things they seem to be doing right now is creating the entire operating system for a TV.
Right.
The forward-facing part that the user interacts with, at least. And then providing all the hooks in terms of the menu things and whatnot for the manufacturers to make sure that, you know, you raise the backlight setting and it works properly. Things like that. But that consistent interface, I think, is a tremendous value for them. And that really seems to pull this whole TV together. It's a 4K screen. It seems to have decent HDR output.
Sorry, as soon as you're pulling things together, I'm envisioning like the 9 copies on HD DVD of, you know, a certain film you have called The Big Lebowski.
Oh, no.
Because, you know, it pulls it all together.
It does.
So
it really does,
but they really are pulling it all together.
Compared to the mishmash, compared to most other interfaces I deal with on modern TVs that seem to be abandoned shortly thereafter their release, I am more recommending the Roku system, at least in terms of there's a company that actually pays attention to their software,
right.
And you're more likely to get an update for it and have some personal experience with a 1080p unit they had that I set up for a person. And I, to this day, still really appreciate it. And it also includes that remote, which you may or may not love. It lacks the Amazon button on it, which seems to grind some people's gears. It'd be nice if they had other, whatever. Who cares?
You know, I was looking at a collection.
But it has that microphone input or the headphone input, so
you can
plug it right in and listen that way.
One of the best things about the Roku is that the remote has a headphone jack so that if you want to listen in the wee small hours of the morning, your remote, you plug your headphones into your remote, it's wirelessly connected to your Roku unit, and then you can have, you know, the headphone experience without running a 20-foot cable.
Totally.
All across your living room.
And it's super convenient.
So, you know, Dolby Vision HDR, an excellent 4K picture. I mean, we're not going to mistake this. If you are an enthusiast, if you are an expert, you're going to notice differences between this and, you know, a $5,000 TV from LG
this,
or Samsung.
Specifically color.
But this is a $600 television that does not make you want to vomit, right? Because a lot of 4K televisions we've had issues with. Refresh rates, color issues. Wow. You must have been getting...
The early ones?
Yeah.
Were nothing more than resolution.
Mm-hmm.
And very little other than that. And the cool things about the new video formats is that they've improved color quality to the point where it's super noticeable. And if you have the content and the display to support it, it gives you a far more realistic looking picture than it ever has. More lifelike. And I do not believe this particular P-Series is covering the widest color gamuts that some of the most premium TVs do at, you know, two, three, four times the price. So,
right.
However, it does have the support for these formats. It will accept all the current, you know, HDR, Dolby Vision, blah, blah, blah. It has capable HDMI inputs, 2.2 compliant. So AC Wi-Fi.
You know, full array local dimming on the screen. Which is, for, you know, you're talking about a $600 television with 72 contrast control zones.
They saw what Vizio was doing and said, you know what?
We can do that.
We have to do something to make these LCDs look better. So that helps.
You know, and this is, again, this is a $600 television with an operating system that should continue to have support. You know, quality picture, Dolby Vision, HDR10.
Yep. Well, the things you're missing specifically will be, compared to like an OLED, will be off-axis viewing. It's going to degrade quickly in terms of its contrast and saturation as you move seats to the side if you're not in that sweet spot. And the other being that the color performance.
Right.
You're not getting the most saturated, accurate representation of the latest video formats compared to some of the very best TVs out there right now. So, but what a tremendous... $600
Yeah.
For the, I think the 55-inch on this one.
55-inch. The 50-inch and the 65-inch will be out later this year. Chris Welch, the reviewer, also notes that it has some of the best lag times he's seen. So if you're a gamer,
cool,
you should put this on your short list.
Good value.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
Yeah, if you can't get to that 2000 approximately price point for screen and get into OLEDville, then these are the kinds of screens you're, you're paying more attention to. It's like, why spend $1,500, $1,600, $1,700 on an LCD?
Right.
At that point, I would rather tell you to save your money and save up for that OLED. Because in the long run, those displays look fan-freaking-tastic.
Yeah. Quality assurance is not going to be as high. QA, build quality, is not going to be as consistent as LG or Samsung. That's one of the things...
That's true, too. He actually points out in this review that he did receive a hand-selected unit from TCL, and it looked fantastic. But other folks have reported things like uniformity issues with the seal around the edge of the panel.
Right. Blooming.
All your typical LCD stuff. And an episode or two ago, we talked about a couple ways of dealing with that on a panel to help at least see if it can be fixed. There's a couple of ways to do that. But otherwise, yeah. Tremendous value.
Apparently already out of stock on Amazon. Amazon's the exclusive seller currently.
Oh, convenient.
Well, you know, it's a good review. Link to that is in the show notes. If you know, you won't be able to buy one right now, but you should be able to buy one again soon.
I absolutely love buying brand new TVs online and having them shipped right to the door unopened. You know, there's something about that. It's like I don't have to deal with the transportation. As long as the people actually bringing it to your door have worked with displays before and aren't just stacking them flat in the back of the truck and letting them bounce everywhere. But
throwing their bowling balls
in. I don't see that as much as I used to, at least. So anyway.
ask@avxl.com is the email address. You can reach Robert and I directly straight into our brains via the screen. We love your questions. I'm going to ask you guys and gals a question, and I'd love to hear your response. If you are an enthusiastic consumer of the operating system that came with your television, send us an email, ask@avxl.com. Tell us what the television is, what the operating system is, and why you like it. Because I, you know, part of the reason Robert's so enthusiastic about Roku is because I tortured him with a sharp pointy stick earlier this year until he admitted that almost every operating system we've seen introduced with a television has been abandoned.
It's the last choice I go to.
Yeah.
It's the last option in my list of where to go first for how to stream the content I want.
So if you are...
99% of the time, external devices.
Yeah, they just make things simpler. But if you have an operating system on your TV you think's doing a great job, I would love to hear about it, even if it's Roku, which obviously we're enthusiastic about. And we want to hear all your questions, your tips, your ideas, your thoughts. And, hey, we appreciate it. We also appreciate everybody that's supporting us on patreon.com/AVXL. That is a place you can go to help us make the show possible without advertising.
Totally. And we provide benefits to our loyal subscribers.
Oh, my goodness. The Focal, French speaker manufacturer.
I've heard a few good sounding things from them.
Oh, my goodness. I got to hear their Sopra
number three speakers, I believe, down in Southern California not too long ago. Phenomenal speaker. Should be. It's a $20,000 speaker.
Super premium. At least some of their.
Yeah. Well,
they have the variety, I'm sure.
You know, I think once you get above $5,000 for a pair of speaker, I'm going to call that super premium.
Yeah.
There are some people out there that will call that entry level, but, you know, they're beyond.
Deaf.
Yeah. You know, let's not get mean.
No. Not deaf. Oh, I shouldn't say deaf. Too much cash dust in their ears. It needs to be cleaned out.
Too much money clogging the earballs. Humorous comments about $20,000 speakers aside. They are also the company that makes Focal's Utopia, the incredible beryllium headphones with the open back.
We occasionally get into discussions about magnets, and yeah.
That's one of the greatest magnets ever made.
Exactly.
For anything ever.
You're paying for that magnet in that speaker.
That glorious magnet.
Among much else.
That's a $4,000 set of headphones. So I was really curious, right? They did their first in-ear about a year and a half ago, the Focal Spear, which was really impressive. Very expensive when it came out, about $180. They're actually about to be replaced with the Spear Model S. And the big deal, though, is they came out with the Focal Spark.
It sounds smaller?
It is smaller.
Okay.
Right? So the Spear's kind of trippy. It's about 19 millimeters. They're selling for under $100 now. The original Focal Spear, the Spear S, is going to come out in July. I'm very, very curious to hear that because the Spear sounded fantastic. It was just kind of expensive for what it was when it came out.
But at $100 for the original,
$100,
if you could find it,
it is one of the most sort of spacious and open earbuds I have ever used.
Cool.
Certainly at the price range.
Electrostatic-ish?
No, I'm not going to go quite that far.
Okay,
but you know, electrostatic started like $3,000 to $5,000 and quickly climbed to ridiculous, but. The Spears have something around a 10.8 millimeter driver inside of them. And the Spark, which is a new $69 earbud from Focal, has a 9.5 millimeter driver. So very, very small. I like the style. It's got this sort of, you know, Focal logo on it, brushed silver back, available in black and white, a flat cable, 10.8 millimeter driver in that Spear S.
You think about about a centimeter.
Yeah.
In an earbud.
Yeah.
That sounds well built.
It is. I mean, you know,
or at least it sounds like it should be engineered. It has the initial horsepower at least to get it going. So
but the Spark's really interesting, right? Because first thing I listened to, Amber Rubarth, Song of the 17th Ward, right? We've talked about Chesky binaural recording, amazing. It
sounds great on a
sound phenomenal
pair of anything.
Very bass heavy.
Okay.
Obviously, somebody tuned this for people who like bass. And what made it so interesting is there's for a $70 earbud, right? That's the street or the MSRP, $70, $69. Fantastic, like senses of the room,
really?
Tons of detail, gorgeous sound. A little bass heavy.
Really?
But this is listening to Amber Rubarth with a percussionist and a cello player.
Oh no. Usually one of the things I look at in earbuds is that as the price goes up, bass response seems to improve.
Yeah.
And it goes the opposite way too, where typically the lower they go, it's like, he's just so if they can
well,
be something sub $100,
the kind of bass response
like decent. Response.
They're claiming like 20 hertz to 20,000 hertz. I think it's fallen off pretty far, but you can still hear 20 hertz when you run a test tone through it. I'd say 30 hertz is probably closer to 1 to 3 decibels
still,
on drop off.
Value.
Here's the thing though, when I turned the volume up, a little Rage Against the Machine. When you got something that was like fully rocking.
Dynamic.
Yeah, there was a little too much bass, and the whole, you know, like we've seen in a lot of inexpensive Mylar earbuds. It kind of fell apart.
The tuning collapsed a little.
I think over-modulating might be the word I would use if I was trying to be fancy and misuse engineering terms. But
hey.
It's an interesting earbud. They have that. They have a Bluetooth version of it that just came out. Fantastic until I turned the volume up. I gave it to a second person with a different device. And a different set of tunes. They ran into the same. Their description was that it became kind of shrill or shrieky when they turned the volume up, which is a real disappointment because it's a fantastic sounding earbud until you try to, you know. And, you know, when I say rock out, you could also be jamming with, like, you know, an orchestral thing where just there's just a whole lot of
right.
Flight of the Valkyries. They're bringing a lot there. Mozart on a heavy day. There's a lot going on there. You know,
low volume listening.
Fantastic.
Yeah. But if you need to push it on the subway train or with your favorite dynamic track,
not gonna be.
Probably not as impressive as you might want it to
be. I'm still going to say stick to the one more at that point.
There you go.
So just a thought on that. Ooh. One more has actually come out with a lightning version. Should you
I was
going
to say, I just saw that email. I'm ready to get some ears on that as well.
I am very curious about that one. So, yeah, we did a full review video up on TechThing episode 130, link in the show notes.
Oh, cool.
Let us go to a viewer question. Christian emailed ask@avxl.com. Hey, guys. Quick question. I've been using Red Fox software to rip my Blu-rays. My subscription ran out, and I'm having issues with purchasing it because it's out of China, and my bank doesn't like that. Any software you recommend that does the same thing as Red Fox so I can rip my purchased movies? Christian. Fantastic question. One, there's really no software quite like Red Fox.
Yeah. In
terms of any DVD,
a tray tool that just sat there and stayed out of the way and just took care of the main issue, which is the encrypted format used on these discs.
And this is, you know, do us a favor. Don't rent a movie and rip a copy of it and then, you know, return the movie. Do this with movies you own. Don't be a jerk. Make sure that people who make movies make a living.
No, actually buy them too, because sometimes rental copies aren't exactly the same as the theatrical releases, I find.
Yeah. That's a whole nother conversation.
I kind of don't miss the rental stores anymore. I'll be honest with you. There are still a few abandoned buildings around that I like to drive by and video only.
There's actually a place in my town that's,
or no, that's actually an AV
that does DVD and a fair amount of VHS, which is so odd to me. So I generally go to Redbox.
I could
I'm
imagine the demographics
online.
Of your neighborhood are. I remember handing my relatively unused VHS deck to someone in the last couple of years. Through a Craigslist transaction, and they were happy. And they were older. But
so,
anyway.
You know, Redbox is essentially a project, they say, not a company, that rose out of the ashes of Slysoft. Slysoft got litigated out of existence. They were the original creators of any DVD HD.
And a great virtual drive program, too. I think it was Clone CD.
Clone CD.
I think it was called.
So Redbox is out of Belize, but they can't really get like a tier one US or EU credit card processor. Aww. So they use what I will affectionately call a third tier processor out of China, which is why, you know, your bank's like, oh, no. This is obviously something nefarious. Somebody's stolen your credit card number.
I wonder if they accept Bitcoin.
In theory, any Visa card should work.
Yeah.
You could, if your Visa card won't work, you can either call your bank and say you want to let this charge through and see if your bank will let you do that. Two, the advice on the Red Fox website is that a Green Dot prepaid card from Walmart will take care of this for you because it allows for international purchasing. Or you could pay with Bitcoin and get an extra 10% off.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's all of this is kind of detailed at forum.redfox.bz/forum/purchase-and-license-keys. It's pretty easy to find on that one.
But with that software, that by itself allows you to drop a disk in the drive, right-click it, dump it to an image file, ISO, or I guess whatever format you want.
Right.
And then from there, you can do with it what you want. You can drop it through a video compression tool like Handbrake, or you can just leave it as is and mount it in a virtual drive and play to your heart's content without little warnings popping up and so forth. I'll be curious to see how everyone's dealing with the Sony-backed the security system that was being integrated into audio that was stumbling up a few folks trying to do backups of the discs they own. There was actually an embedded audio system that was pretty dang good about just sticking around long enough for these player software packages to be able to detect it and made things interesting. But yeah, that tool. And other than that, the only other one I even glance at is Make MKV.
Yeah.
And that's just another tool that I haven't used it enough, really. But that was
Shannon's been using it a lot. Shannon, my co-host in TechThing, has been using it a lot. It is a classic. As a matter of fact, I think Macworld. Shannon just did a tutorial on how to rip DVDs and Blu-rays. Macworld just did a tutorial on how to use, you know, how to rip your content off DVDs and Blu-rays.
I've written those articles before.
Yeah, I think we've all written them.
But the nice thing about MKV is it's a container format.
And the beauty of it for things like old school formats, even like HD DVD, mm-hmm. was that it would rip it and preserve all the original audio,
right?
Full video quality, and it's a container format that, as long as the things within the container are supported by the player, will play back on a surprising number of portable devices, TVs, and everything. I see MKV support pretty ubiquitous nowadays. Yeah. So
Handbrake would be the other tool people use where you take the video.
If you wanted to mash the video down to something else, squeeze it in some way.
If you wanted to put it on your phone and your tablet.
Yeah, if you didn't need the full resolution, you wanted to make it maybe a 4 gig file instead of a 40, you know, that's the kind of tool you'd use for that. But
Handbrake, free, open source, and glorious.
And now with some hooks, finally, for hardware video compression.
Oh, my goodness.
Via Intel.
Reminder, 20% off sale till July 9th on Red Fox's AnyDVD HD. Should you be thinking about picking that up?
Lifetime!
Tyler, a.k.a. at Great Blarg, tweets, quote, "More AVXL. Looking for headphone cable. Similar but cheaper. Any ideas?" And he links to HiFiMan.com, which is the manufacturer of some very lovely planar magnetic headphones. My second planar magnetic headphones came from HiFiMan. I particularly like this because headphone cables are much like speaker cables, where there's a thin line between I need something that's not going to fall apart and will deliver a quality signal from my amplification to my, you know, ear speaker or headphone. And then it immediately goes off a cliff into, I have so much money, I really need braided silver cables that have been knitted together in Bavarian woods under the light of the moon while being softly spooned with, you know, rabbit tail.
Yeah, I mean, it's a quality interconnect and an undamaged wire.
Yeah.
That's really all I need.
I know people whose ears I trust. Yeah. Who have been able to discern audible differences between speaker cables.
With gauges in particular.
Yeah.
Over a certain gauge, it seemed like once the wire was thick enough, it seemed to matter a whole lot less.
Yeah, and it's like once you've got like a 12-gauge decent copper wire, you know, I have spools of the stuff. I have a 100-foot spool of the stuff from Monoprice, you know, sitting in the warehouse right now because Lord knows I'm hooking up lots of speakers because I'm insane. But you know, once you get up to a 12-gauge speaker wire, you're pretty much there for most purposes.
For custom stuff, I look at companies like Blue Jeans Cable.
Yeah.
They will make you using the best wires, the best termination technologies and testing. And all the information and learning you ever wanted to know about a damn cable, they're fantastic.
So all of that said, you know, if you want to buy, if you think of silver cable,
orange, bright orange,
with you know,
with
custom
purple interconnects,
it's
got to be that color.
Don't mock
the client is insane.
You know, if it brings you happiness,
hey, that's what I said.
Here's the thing, though, right?
That's beautiful. That is beautiful.
Poor
is it
Tyler.
Halloween?
Tyler's like, you were going to answer my question?
Maybe.
Here's the thing, though. When you're listening to it, like, you know, your source is like 90% of your audio, and your speaker or your earbud or your ear speaker or your headphone is another 90% of the audio. And as long as you don't have crappy amplification, that's another 90% of the audio. And then I'd say 0.05% of the audio is your cable. You know, as long as you're not using, you know, some janky, corroded, you know, beat to snot, half broken.
The old Christmas tree lights.
Yeah, which I actually have seen something not quite Christmas tree lights.
It's so beautiful.
I looked at a friend of mine and I'm like, did you tear the cord off your mom's lamp to hook that speaker up?
Hey.
It's like, I wanted to hear music.
Hey, man. Got to MacGyver this immediately.
It sounded fine. But so Tyler's run into a question. You know, Tyler, there's one of the nice things as you start spending more money on headphones, you know, almost, you know, it's shocking if you get a headphone. If you spend more than a couple $100 on headphones, they almost always have replaceable cables. Not necessarily because they want you to go buy a solid silver cable that's designed to destroy your
wear
bank
and
account.
Tear.
Yeah, literally, because they expect you to use these for years and cables wear out. They get broken. They
get
stepped on.
I hate keyboards that do not have removable cables. Mm-hmm. I have like mechanical keyboards that I absolutely love. And the fact that I have to like unwire the damn thing and I can't just disconnect it and go clean it. Anyway.
Oh, my goodness.
I feel you. So, similar. but not quite.
You know, Tyler had a link to the crystalline cable. It's available 2 meter, 3 meter, 5 meter, 8 meter up on Hi-Fi Man. This is crystalline copper and crystalline silver composite cable with a 6.35 millimeter stereo headphone plug and a fabric jacket.
I'm sure it's delicious.
Yeah, it's designed for the HE series headphones. So here's the thing. Like, the cable on my first set of Hi-Fi Man headphones basically disintegrated. They were using a very stiff plastic. And not a particularly great. They're one of the things that makes cable last longer is having a graceful sort of plastic that creates a radius when you go from the connector to the cable. Because if the cable can just bend 90 degrees to the connector, that's, you know, kind of a guaranteed fail point, no matter how careful you are, eventually. Hi-Fi Man also, they do not currently use them, but they used to use a very peculiar, you know, basically a high-frequency antenna-style connector, which I'm sure was fantastic for creating... you know, sort of a non, you know, it was probably
like
fantastic.
A BNC connector or something, or a...
more like what you would see on a connected to like a 2.4 or a 5 gigahertz Wi-Fi antenna.
Just a RF jack kind of style.
But, you know, you would have to screw the cables on and
it
you would have to like, you know,
off.
Find a wrench to make sure they were tight enough if you couldn't get them finger tight enough. And they were stuck very far out of the bottom of the headphones. So in any case, the cable on my first set of Hi-Fi Man headphones disintegrated. And I was looking at like, you know, I bought them used. Like, it was a $400 set of the original HE400s. I bought them used for like $200, and I wasn't going to spend $200 on a replacement cable, especially not if it was possibly made as poorly as the original cable. Fortunately, they don't use those weird connectors anymore. So I ended up going to a place called Best in the Verse Cables. And anytime you've got something that sounds like a Firefly reference, I'm golden.
Yep.
But they are one of a number of, you know, custom cable manufacturers. Mimic-cables.com is another one. And they make nice, basic copper cables. They wrap them in paracord, so you can pick whatever color paracord you want for them. You get to choose the style of plug you want. Like, you know, they offer Best in the Verse has like ViaBlue 3.5 and 6.3 millimeters, Nutrix XLR connectors, Oyade 3.5 millimeter. Basically, you have a selection of like really nice, you know, if I'm wiring cables myself, for years I had a stash of Nutrix, you know, quarter inch and, excuse me, 6.3 millimeter.
Oh, yeah.
Quarter inch and eighth inch phono adapters. If they're good enough to use in the studio, they're good enough for me. But you get to choose the different options on the cable and they'll build it up. And they even have little cable splitters. So there's like a little barrel that covers the spot where the one, you know, the one cable becomes the left and right cables to the ears. You know, I think I paid $69 for a cable, which on one hand is a lot of money, but I wasn't going to track down a pair of these HF connectors and solder it myself. You know, so I thought that crew was pretty impressive. I hear nice things about Mimic cables. The other thing is to sort of shop around as much as you can, because if you nose around on there's eBay manufacturers who are sending stuff straight from China, you may or may not trust them.
Do you have an upper limit on the length of a headphone cable? It seems to me you don't want it more than a couple meters, I would think.
I
guess it depends on the technology and everything and the signaling, but
no, for me, I can't audibly tell a huge difference between I can't tell any difference between a 3 foot and a 6 foot cable.
Oh no, okay. Shorter distances, no. But I'm thinking, man, if you really...
The issue I have run into is that if the cable is too long, it invariably catches on something and then rips, either tears on the jack in my phone or my audio player, my beloved AK100. Yeah, it does damage or gets ripped out of the bottom of the headphone. So for me, like a 3 or 4 foot cable, that something that goes from my ears to my pocket with enough slack that I can, you know, walk around without tugging on the headphones. That's as long as I need. Anything longer than that, I'm going to use an extension cable.
That interface between the wire and the speaker itself or the earbud itself, that's the point of failure. Or the connector itself. Ugh. I've had it all go one way or another. Actually, I've had very few actual 3.5 millimeter jacks fail.
I haven't had any fail in a very long time.
The jack itself, I don't think I've had fail on me. But
yeah, I mean, I can totally understand why Tyler was asking about this, because if you nose around, there's a whole section of cables on the Hi-Fi Man. It's like store.hifiman.com. You can go to the cable section, and it's like, you know, $300, $179, $150, $130. There's like a silver-coated copper cable that's 3 meters long, which is kind of long for me, but that's with the older connectors that they don't use for headphones anymore. So you're looking at $130 for a headphone cable for a set of headphones that new, I think, are selling for like $250. So, you know, again, you can search. There are options from manufacturers I don't know a lot about, in many cases sending straight from China on eBay and on Amazon.com. I've had great luck with Best in the Verse cables. I like the work they do. Mimic cables looks like they're doing some good job. Used cables occasionally show up if you hang out in the audio forums. So hopefully, Tyler, you know, and if you're feeling it, you could also make your own cable. But I can totally understand if you have no interest in doing that, because making a headphone cable is a little more complicated than making a RCA cable or a
I'll terminate cable. Cat cable. I won't terminate HDMI or not that I even could.
You know, it's some of the connectors.
Many things I would just say, hey, please have this factory done with the right tooling.
Well, that's part of the problem. And precision. Is some of the headphones out there
minimal
have
slop.
Some bizarre proprietary connectors on them, and I'm sure, you know,
especially once you get into the fancy electrostatics too.
Yeah, Odyssey. Well, even like Odyssey's planar magnetics have some. They're great interconnects, but I don't think I want to deal with tracking them down and trying to solder them. But yeah, I mean, like I said, there's options out there. We'll have links to those companies in the show notes.
Cool.
Keep an eye out for them. One. Cabron Photo tweets, hey, at AVXL, at Tech Thing, what green surge protectors do you guys recommend for a home theater AV setup and a home gaming editing office? You know, if you're looking for a straight surge protector, I would go straight to the wire cutter selection. You know, it's a fantastic, if you've ever wanted to learn everything about surge protectors, you know, this is a pretty amazing article.
They actually recommend a product I think I own.
Yeah.
A Triplite. Triplite. I think it's a company out of Illinois. They have been making power strips and adapters and other products like that for a long time.
Yeah.
And the only thing that makes it green is in the sense that it's switchable. You can have a primary device and then all of the other outlets can be triggered to it. Usually that's what it means. It's some kind of way to just fully cut the power to a particular port. Right. So you don't have, you know, vampiric losses of whatever.
Right. The surge protector itself should not be consuming any electricity until you start plugging things into it.
Yeah, or it's got the indicator lights on it, which are incurring ridiculously little power usage. It's like an LED or something like that. I use around for pro installations or more permanent installations, I prefer Triplite steel encased power strips. Mm-hmm. Those things are built like a tank. You could hurt somebody with these things. I will always plug that into the wall first and then plug devices into that. Even if it's going to be something like an uninterrupted power supply, I will always put that power strip in front of it. And ideally, if you're in like a public situation, you then would have everyone use a power strip on their own setup plugged into another power strip. That way, if you're going to deal with potential failure, it'll hopefully stop at that point. I've also just had bad power within a building come racing through, and that is the last line of defense before it's going to reach your components.
Our friend Josh, somebody what basically amounted to an intern working for PG&E somehow managed to send 440 volts through the city block he was living on in San Francisco.
Joy, watch your outlets melt.
It blew out every electrical device in his house that was plugged in. His refrigerator, his stove, his electric stove got smoked. I mean, I can't imagine what the
On a more realistic level, though, it's my freaking laser printer in my office. Every time that kicks on, man, it draws just enough initial wattage, and it triggers my uninterrupted power supply that my workstation's off of. So you could just imagine, it's just like if you had a laser printer on the same circuit every day, just tricking or tickling the power enough to just, you know, it's probably touching maybe a power supply or something only and affecting that. But over time, those are the little things that will add up to product failure of any kind. So at the very least, something that could stop a surge, but better yet, a line conditioner uninterrupted power if you don't need a battery system. At least get a line conditioner that's active and can deal with sagging power over short periods of time.
It's interesting, like I said, the Wirecutter article is a really fascinating read because they get into the nitty-gritty of how surge protectors work, what they do and what they don't do. You know, one of the things they noticed is some of the more expensive surge protectors promise noise filtering, but the reality is noise filtering is invariably done on the power supply in your device. If you have some extreme issues with static showing up, that might be one reason to look for some additional noise filtration. But
it's the other thing too, with at least trip light products, generally the banks of outlets are isolated, at least down to pairs. So that's another nice way. If you have one of those funky devices that, you know, is a noisy product or something, happens to be putting noise back into the system, it offers a little more isolation that way. But yeah.
It's
not the be-all, end-all solution. It's great if you live especially somewhere. Mm-hmm. If you've ever had lightning hit your house and destroy half your stuff, anything and everything you can do. That's probably where you need more of a whole house setup. But, yeah.
That's a different conversation for another day. It's funny. There are some incredibly expensive power conditioning systems.
I think Triplight makes one of my favorites, actually. I use that in home theater setups all the time.
Which one?
They have it depending on the wattage rating you need. It's like from 1,800 watts on up to 2,500 mm-hmm. watts.
Series mode protection is interesting, but also incredibly more expensive. Brickwall makes those. Taurus Power makes those. There's links to those in that Wirecutter article. We'll have links in the show notes.
Here we go. 1,200. The 1,200 watt unit on Amazon is about $90. And if you need one that goes, and like I said, they have them on up to 1,800, 2,400, blah, blah, blah. It depends on how much protection you need.
So the Triplight 1,200 watt line conditioner?
Yep.
With automatic voltage regulator, AC surge protection, and four outlets?
That will deal with sagging. Like when my laser printer kicks on, or when my when the house owner is using his electric lawnmower outside on the same damn circuit, and I'm like, oh, it's bad enough. I don't have my TV hooked up to anything, and so I know that the power supply within the TV is handling all of that. However, for my workstation and the things I truly depend on in my life, TV is one thing, but the workstation with all my data and crap, that's sitting behind not only something like a Triplight,
right?
Outlet, but a line conditioner / UPS. So
good to know.
Yeah.
Wow. I'm looking at this Brickwall website that was linked from the Wirecutter article. I'm going to close that because I'm just going to go way down the rabbit hole way too quickly. But
I was looking at solar technology and I found a single graph that sent me so far down the hole. It was awesome, but at the same point, yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah. So hopefully, Kevin, that gives you some ideas to work with on that. You know, start low cost and simple and work your way up from there.
Totally.
Because if you want to spend thousands of dollars, you know.
And remember, the whole green thing is generally just switching individual outlets.
Most devices, if they've been made in the last couple of years, don't have a lot of vampiric power draws. I will also say, while I am down with saving the energies, the vampiric power draw on most devices is going to be considerably less than leaving an LED light bulb on 24/7. So.
Probably. A lot of the TVs I look at do actually have their fast start modes enabled by default, which will consume more power. So, and I'd rather have that TV turn on quicker than take a minute. So.
One last question before we head out of here. At Cousin Dave tweets, at Audioholics Live, at AVXL, at AV Rant Tom, I thought Pioneer was getting out of the AV receiver business. Well, not exactly, but yeah, they did. Pioneer Home Entertainment, and it had a link to a new Pioneer AV receiver. Pioneer Home Entertainment became part of Onkyo, or what some of the Onkyo / Pioneer employees call Ponkyo. It was back in 2015. Pioneer Electronics USA still does car electronics, optical disc technology, and they do a lot of business engineering for major car manufacturers.
Man, when the DVD format, recordable format, first came out, that was their drives. They were the first ones you could get. It was always... their optical side, I really have a lot of respect for. And car audio.
Yeah. I've had a every head unit I've bought in the last decade has been from Pioneer. And they still have I had a great interview with one of their executives and realized that there are a lot more people buying head units than you would think. It's still a thing, especially for people like me who drive 20-year-old trucks. But Pioneer Electronics USA is essentially a different company from the Pioneer that's doing the AVRs and the older Andrew Jones design speakers.
Clearly got out of the TV business a while ago.
A long time ago. But, you know, those are legit you know, and Onkyo is making some good stuff. Pioneer is making some good home theater stuff. And Pioneer, you know, USA, or Pioneer Electronics USA, is making good stuff. And, you know, they're doing the car electronics and the speakers.
I would hope they don't dilute the brand too much in terms of just maintain.
I don't think they
do. If you're going to label anything Pioneer, I expect it to be a little bit better, even on the value side.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, Pioneer, you know, it's
but what do I know?
At this point, what you know is limitless. No, it's a very they do some interesting stuff. They also do some cycle sports stuff, bicycle stuff. Essentially, you know, that's a completely unrelated, but they make special cranks that allow you to test the amount of like torque that's being applied by the human leg. It's fascinating.
I may have used some of these devices in rehab.
You may have. In any case, Pioneer is still around. It's just part of a venture or a combined Pioneer Onkyo thing, to use a highly technical term.
Coolio.
Oh, my goodness. Daniel Day-Lewis has announced his retirement from acting. He's got one more film directed by Paul Thomas Anderson coming down the pike. So if you enjoy Daniel Day-Lewis and There Will Be Blood, there should be one more scenery-chewing, visually stunning epic coming from that duo before Daniel Day-Lewis retires once again. And what is the Terranex Mini?
Oh, I spent a couple of days with a sweet box from Blackmagic Designs, a $500 unit you can pick up called the Terranex 12G, and the particular unit I was using, they make varieties of these with different functionality, but this one specifically was for accepting up to 4K 60 signals, HDR video, up to 12 gigabit, and basically converting SDI into HDMI output.
Oh, interesting.
So this was more in a pro environment, but what we needed to do was to accurately configure an E6 OLED from LG, a consumer OLED, for use in more of a pro-style environment. And sure, you can do a good calibration on two displays, and especially when the technologies are different, like an LCD versus OLED, things will look different. Contrast performance alone on two different displays can really change the appearance, especially when it comes to color appearance. Things measure identical, but they look different. And one of the ways to get around all of that is to slip a device in there where you kind of leave the TV in its default state and then have the box then take all of that output that would be going to that TV and then optimize it so that when it is displayed with the default setup, it looks perfect. And in the case of the Blackmagic 12G box, their Terranex Mini, what I was able to do with this was run thousands of measurements on a display and then take that and create a correction table, literally a spreadsheet of numbers that then allows the video feeding into that OLED to be corrected to a degree that goes far beyond what you're able to do just the controls built into a set. Fairly automated process, yet time consuming. And I couldn't be more thrilled. The results came out fantastic. The support from the company was really good too. I had one, of course, it failed until like 5 minutes into the tech support phone call, and then it was working for whatever reasons perfectly. I'm assuming an error between the chair and keyboard on that one.
It's been known to happen.
But otherwise, yeah, if you absolutely have to dive into LUT boxes, this one is programmable with the software I use, either from SpectraCal or I want to say another group too. There's a couple of the big LUT generating software packages out there, and it just worked fantastic. Upload speeds in terms of the file created, in terms of the LUT file uploads, seconds. Interface can either be network, or the initial setup actually did require a mini USB cable. But easy, not a lot, especially in this particular case where it's just doing SDI to HDMI output. There's almost no configuration other than to say, hey, do you want to use LUT number one, LUT number two, or bypass the LUTs, or for and a couple other features too that you may or may not need. But interesting, man. It was really nice to be able to, in a very automated way, dial in a couple of very diverse displays to be far more close together than you can do just about any. It's not even worth trying to do any other way, really. It's just when you're getting down to that kind of scenario, a LUT box is almost mandatory.
Right.
But There you go. Look up table. If I keep saying LUT and haven't said look up table. What would be neat? There is really, in effect, there are LUTs built into every display. Perhaps only the factory has access to the very lowest level one that is responsible for, you know, the factory setup before it leaves the factory. But it would be neat if there were a couple of programmable lookup tables that we could actually address and feed a corrected file to. That would go a long way toward offering calibration on consumer displays to get them to look as absolutely phenomenally spot on as possible. Especially given the variations and everything with each display manufactured. It'd be kind of neat to be able to actually write that file directly to the TV rather than have a separate box for it. On pro monitors I work with, a lot of them have that ability to upload a LUT right to it. I don't think you can call your monitor a pro monitor unless it accepts multiple LUT files for different setups. So, anyway, I'll quit saying the word LUT. I'll say that the Blackmagic Terranex Mini is one sweet little box, and it worked really well.
There you have it, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, and happy birthday, Quake!
Quake's old enough to drink.
Yes, 21!
Oh, my goodness. I am not even ready to process that concept. So we're going to just walk on out here, people. AskAtAVXL.com is a place to email us with your questions, your tips, your suggestions, your comments. You can catch up with at Robert Herron or at Patrick Norton on the Twitters. At AVXL is a good place to tweet at the, AVXL, if you want to get to both of us at once. And again, if you enjoy the show, please help us keep it going and check out our offerings at patreon.com/AVXL. And with that, I want to thank everybody for listening. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Robert Herron.
We'll catch you next week.